There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is the Mark Boris Podcast.
Good morning. This is the day after Australia Day. Hopefully everybody had a great day, Australia Day. It ended up doing a pretty good weather in Sydney. I had a pretty mad day. I had the usual barbecue and a couple of beers and went to the beach, had a swim, went to my parents' place, did everything Australian. What did you do, Nick, Boris?
I was enjoying your place in Byron Bay.
What about Cabaret?
Thanks for providing.
No worries, Cabaret.
Yeah, Cabaret. On the way home, I stopped off at a mate's place in Cabaret, great part of the world. Probably couldn't get more cliche Australian Day than his place. He's got a fibro house, little blue fibro house with a white picket fence, overgrown backyard. He got his mower out and did a big big bald spot for a makeshift cricket pitch. Had a game of backyard cricket, barbecue, lots of little families running around. It was pretty Australian.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. Forda.
Just a barbecue, mate.
Leave me like that.
Just a barbecue, actually at Lisa Wilkinson's place. Lisa Wilkinson,
cool.
Peter Fitzsimon's place. So
Lisa got the member of Order of Australia.
Order of Australia. Yeah. So
well deserved. Congratulations to everybody who got an award yesterday. And by the way, congratulations to all those people who deserve an award.
Is this the anniversary of your award?
No, I got mine in the Queen's Birthday honours.
Okay, right.
Which was June last year. Which is actually not the Queen's birthday either, by the way, but that's when I got mine. But good on Lisa. She's a beauty. I sent her a text yesterday just to say congratulations. She probably got a shock when I got a text message. Hey, Jakey.
Hello.
Happy Australia Day to you, mate, for yesterday.
Yeah, you too.
What'd you do?
I went and visited my grandma.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, we looked up in Hornsby. We've been researching the family history, so went up there and racked her brain on, you know, the Round and Fisher family.
Was it because you found out you had a grandma or...?
Oh, no. That wasn't a surprise grandma.
Okay. This is a grandma you knew about.
Yeah, grandma I knew about. Just taking interest in the family history and visiting her up in her retirement village thing.
And what are we wearing today, by the way?
I'm in a double velvet blue suit.
Double velvet?
Yeah.
What's double velvet?
Like velvet pants and a velvet jacket.
Oh, my God.
I guess it's double. I don't know.
Yeah, very styling, man. Like, the rest of us look like shitbags, but... You look fantastic.
Oh, thanks.
Well, as always.
Oh, thank you. Well, it is 700 degrees in here, so I'm kind of regretting it now.
It is a bit hot. The air conditioning's not working, but doesn't matter. We'll be right. We'll lose a bit of weight. Okay, well, look, one of the reasons one of the things we always hear about is how does this process of negotiation work? How do you negotiate? And one of the reasons we've got Fordo sitting here at the microphone, Fordo's one of the partners of this business, the TMBS or the Mark Boris Show, but he's normally sitting over there on the couch looking at his emails and stuff like that, looking after his clients. One of the reasons we've got Fordo here is because he's in the management business and it's called the Fordham Group. Is it called the Fordham Group,
Nick? The Fordham Company.
Fordham Company.
Yep.
Maybe you should tell us a little bit about it. I know your dad and your dad started up the business, is that right?
Parents started the business in 1979, the year I was born, had the garage converted. It started as a PR business, so used to look after international airlines and hotels. And
why did your dad start a PR business? I mean, what sort of got him to do that?
Background, he was a journalist, and back in the day, major companies like Qantas, when they wanted a head of PR, would hire a journalist. So rather than hiring someone in PR because it really didn't exist. You know, it's a corporate communications role. So he was a boy from Newcastle, hadn't travelled before, headhunted by Qantas and posted to America for 5 years to run Qantas in North America.
So is that how he knows Paul?
Casey?
Yeah.
Yeah. Through the airline, aviation industry.
Ah, okay, yeah. I didn't know that. I knew Paul, obviously, but I didn't realise that that your dad was involved in that airlines.
So then from the PR business in the early 90s, really before people, there's a famous guy around Sydney, Harry M. Miller.
Yeah, I remember Harry.
Who's not well these days.
No.
And Harry was probably the first real agent around town.
Like talent manager?
Talent manager, but think pre-rugby league being professional, rugby union, AFL, cricket. So it was more of, you know, people like people on television.
Deborah Hutton.
What's that?
Deborah Hutton. Yeah.
So that's how it sort of, the first client was Ricky Stewart.
Your first client?
Our first client was Ricky Stewart.
Is that right? Still is a client, of course.
Still is a client, 20-something years after. And then the next client, the real client was, first official client was John Laws, and back in those days when...
Oh, Laws is a client of Fordham Group.
Yes.
Fordham Company.
Lawsy, so that was 1991. Lawsy was signed with us, and that sort of transformed our business and really... pushed us in this direction because, in those days in commercial radio and Lawsy was on 60-something stations around the country and earning tens of millions a year, it really pushed us in that direction.
And that's the point. So I think one of the hardest things we've observed you, Nick Boris and I have observed you from afar, and of course Fordham Company is my manager too, my agent, particularly when it comes to things like TV and The Apprentice and those sorts of things. One of the things we've observed about you, Nick, and I guess it's sort of DNA-based and also experience-based, you guys are negotiating all the time, and most of the time you negotiate in big organisations. So someone like John Laws, for example, and I don't want you to reveal any secrets, obviously, but someone like John Laws, when he was, one of your early clients, and he made a lot of money, a lot of the money wasn't necessarily just made with the radio station, it was made with sponsors and people wanted to advertise.
The majority of the money, saying commercial radio, is made up of commercial sponsors.
So you have to get in there and negotiate on behalf of your client with, I don't know, Coca-Cola or someone like that.
Yep.
And there's just one out. So it was early days, it was the old man, John.
Yep.
Today, you. At one stage, I guess both of you. And you'd be sitting there arm wrestling with these big organisations who had like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of resources, people, that is. And you're there sort of eyeballing them and trying to say to them, look, my client wants $1 million for this segment. And they're saying, look, our budget's only 100,000. Is that the sort of...
Yeah, I mean, it's... I suppose with our industry, it's the most important thing is having great clients, because you never want to have a client that, that you want $1 million for something and... the other end, they've got 100. You want to know that they want to spend $1 million on your client. So I think having the right talent first, the right client first, is the most important thing.
So the first art of negotiation, the first thing in the art of negotiation, Nick, is that about making sure that you're not going into a negotiation where it's impossible. In other words, it's not $1 million versus 100,000. It's about understanding that there is... some closeness in terms of where the two are going to meet.
There's closeness, but knowing you have something that they want is probably the first step.
How do you identify that?
well, it's probably it's where we've been fortunate as a company of having very hand-selected clients. So, in AFL we have, in my view, the best guy in AFL, which is Paul Roos as a coach, and in rugby league, Ricky Stewart, Craig Bellamy, Andrew Johns, Wally Lewis, those types of guys, cricket, Mark Taylor. So making sure in the industry that you work in that your talent is at the top of the tree. So if that company is wanting to access someone from that field, that you have someone that's very valuable to them and someone's unique and someone who, one of the things we try to do is not overexpose our clients. So they don't have 35 commercial arrangements. The companies that they're with, they've been with, an example like a Mark Taylor is coming up to, 15 years with Fujitsu.
Yeah, yeah.
And so someone like a Fujitsu with a Mark Taylor is that, you know, when people think, when they do their focus groups and research of, you know, every time that people connect summer cricket, Mark Taylor, Fujitsu.
Air conditioning. Japanese air conditioning brand.
So you don't think in summer, you don't think Daikin, you don't think Panasonic, it's Fujitsu, Australia's favourite air.
Tubby's sort of living up to his name, is getting better and better at it.
Of course.
Becoming more recognisable.
So I think that's the important thing of when going to a negotiation of making sure that, you know, you back yourself of knowing
that your product
is something that is highly desirable from the other side's perspective.
Yeah, so like in other words, you know, got to know your product really well, and you've got to know what the demand side is.
Sure.
So that applies to any product or service, not just
100%.
in your case, talent management or people management.
Yeah.
I mean, not to sort of make it sound too sort of ruthless, but your product is people.
100%, yeah.
Mark Taylor is a product that you have to sell in inverted commas.
Yeah, a product, yeah, and he's a brand, you know. He's a trusted and reliable brand that, you know.
So what do you do about that brand? Do you actually help him build that brand in order to make your negotiations on his behalf better? It's just like any customer is talking about, listener now is talking about or thinking about doing a negotiation in relation to their product, and they might be trying to deal with Woolworths and absolutely crapping themselves because they're dealing with a big organisation. I mean, do you suggest that people build the brand up first a little bit, like keep working?
Very much so, yeah. And that's one of the fortunate things about our business, that we've had time to build people up. You know, a lot of our clients, including yourself, have been with us for a long period of time. So you're able to build relationships with people, being able to position them in the right space, making sure that every commercial arrangement that you enter into is going to benefit the next one. So not taking the quick cash and going with a company or a brand that doesn't fit with them, making sure that always, you know, protecting them as a brand and just positioning them in the right space.
So you as the, as the negotiator,
yeah,
are you continually out there in the marketplace, you know, shaking hands, talking to people, meeting people in various big organisations, trying to work out whether or not which one of your clients, which one of your client and their brand may actually fit into that organisation's message that they want to send? So, for example, are you out there all the time talking to, watch companies, car companies, airline companies, and just sort of mentally sort of analysing, well, you know, I got this particular client, that client, their brand might actually fit into the message that this particular airline is trying to sell.
Yeah.
Is that what you do?
Yeah, I do. And I encourage my staff as well to always dig through publications, whether it's Ad News or pulling out the Weekend Australian Lift Out Colour magazine on the weekend, just see what companies are doing, what message they're trying to get across, where they're spending, just to really keep your finger on the pulse. One of the great things that I've inherited from my old man and my mum is relationships, you know. So I always try to find that rather than going to companies cold all the time, you know, to make sure that you build as many relationships, no matter what you're doing, you know, pressing the flesh and shaking hands and following up with people. It's, you know, I think relationships is such an important thing in any negotiation. So any company trying to go in cold or when their product's not as sophisticated as it should be, it's, you know, make sure you build the brand first and then go in and try to negotiate. Don't try to negotiate, you know, with someone as big as Woolworths without really establishing your brand or your product.
And also relationships. Because that's sort of interesting what you just said. Not only are you doing your research as to who the potential interested entities might be to sell the product, in other words, use that product for their particular business. In the case, it could be Woolworths using a product for the shelf, one of our listeners. It could be an airline using one of your clients to send a message that they want to send. It could be an air conditioning company like Fujitsu using Mark Taylor to sell their message, that is, be cool in the summer, particularly when you're watching the cricket. Not only are you out there looking, so this is what people who are listening to the show, not only are you out there looking for the potential users of the product, which is what you've got to do if you're listening to the show and you've got a new business, but also you're out there building relationships with those organisations. And it would seem to me one of the best ways you build a relationship in any situation is you build familiarity. Because with familiarity with the familiarity with the organisation is going to be paying the fee. To build familiarity, you've got to, when you're building familiarity, you build trust. And the way you do it is you tell people, you know, a little bit about what they're doing. So you know about what that particular organisation does. If it's Woolworths, you know what Woolworths does. You know what the individual within that Woolworths does. You invite him to the tennis, or you might invite him to something or other, or you find something that is common ground between the two of you.
Yeah.
And then you communicate. You've got to communicate. So there's no point trying to negotiate cold. I mean, like, you've got a new product, you want to get on the shelves of Woolworths, just don't, I mean, you can try, you can send them an email. But it's probably going to bounce on you because you don't know anybody there. You've got to find a person there to send it to, and maybe it's better to be sent it to Coles, Woolworths and Aldi, all three. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it's next to impossible to try and sell something in Coles, especially with a company the size of Woolworths, you know, a difference of having a product. You know, I'm fortunate enough, we've covered on previous podcasts, one of my business partners on another project is Adam McDougall and the Manshake. Because it's, and where we've had so much success is that is because it's such a unique product and it stands alone. And I find so many people that you hear their great ideas, but they sort of sound like another product, you know, that point of difference of something that really stands on its own and is highly desirable. And that's why seeing when people are trying to launch a new gluten-free organic pot of nuts or something, it's like, well, you walk into a supermarket, there's a whole aisle of nuts. So,
but what's the difference? I mean, that's a funny thing because I was thinking about this last night, actually, exactly this point. Why does, and I didn't think of Adam McDougall, but why does Adam McDougall able to sell his product better than the 100 other punters out there who've got the same sort of product, similar sort of product, and it may even be as nutritious, it may be just as nutritional, maybe just as good. Is it not the product, but it's more Adam McDougall?
The product's superior, but we've very carefully over the last 18 months built key relationships with. So when I first started working with Adam, I said, we need to make you an expert, especially taking him from a former athlete. I said, we need to obviously still, you know, ensure that people respect that you're a former athlete, but make sure you become an expert in your field of someone in health and nutrition. So first step was pitching to the Sunday Telegraph a weekly column called Mad Fit, of which we go on the lives of famous people and get one health tip from them, which they can every punter can put into their own life or exercise regime. So that was the first step of, so he became a columnist of health and nutrition. And then the next thing that came is a 2-book deal with Penguin. So all of a sudden he then became an author in the health and wellness space. And then as soon as we did those, then everything else came. So now he writes for news.com and Huffington Post and, you know, those types of things. And now he's on the Today Show as a health expert. So rather than him being on there and talking about Rabbitohs playing the Roosters this weekend, he's now in there talking about, exercise fads and weight loss and nutrition. So
reinventing,
yeah. And it's taken about 18 months, but, and it's difficult as well. I suppose it's a benefit him already having a profile, that helped, but especially when you had a profile as a professional athlete and as a rugby league player, to sort of flip it on its head in a short period of time. But we couldn't have done that with, you know, if the product was full of sugar and it didn't work, you know.
But is the product what he sells, or is the product Adam McDougall? Which part? Where's the product? Where's the product?
The product's the product, because I suppose his background, obviously being a professional athlete, and then as soon as he retired, that he saw a lot of his ex-teammates getting a bit of a beer gut and feeling a bit depressed, and, you know, that transition of professional athlete into the next 25 years of their lives where they got to earn money. He just saw a product and thinking, you know, all weight loss products, majority full of sugar. Protein, because it's a supplement, it's unregulated. So if he could bring a meal replacement that's low in sugar, high in protein, and it's highly regulated because we're a food, he just saw a complete hole in the market. And as well, you know, smart guy, he thought, I want to own a product. You know, I don't want to – he just got out of investment banking and thought, you know, I don't want to work for someone. I want to own a product. So saw a clear hole in the market, built the Manshake, and rest is history.
But do you think that when Adam McDougall goes in to negotiate with Woolworths, there is as much effort and cred coming out of who Adam McDougall is and the way he presents himself,
yeah,
as there is in relation to the product itself? So the product, let's say the product is superior.
Yep.
I accept what you say.
Yep.
Let's say it tastes superior, and let's say it's packaged superior. You know, it looks right, all those sorts of things. But let's say, for argument's sake, we picked someone off the street who slept there overnight, was all dressed like shit, couldn't string a sentence together, and they went to Woolworths and pitched this product. I mean, I'm going to the extreme.
Yeah.
How important is the Adam McDougall part?
It's very important, but one of... Going back a step, where we talk about relationships, is that, you know, one of the biggest partners of the NRL is Woolworths. So the relationship, his relationship with the NRL and the NRL's relationship with Woolworths and trying to promote healthy eating and nutrition with kids and everything. So rather than us just going in straight into Woolworths or Coles, you know, we've used what's important to Woolworths. Well, important to Woolworths is kids and nutrition and the relationship with the NRL. So we've used the relationship
leverage.
With the leverage side of things. But yeah, I mean, just someone walking off the street with a product into a beast like a Woolworths is
penetrate.
Next to impossible.
So in terms of those people listening, in negotiation, you've got to really pick your mark and you've got to work on it.
Yeah.
You can't expect to do it.
And build your product first.
Yeah.
And spend your money on marketing and social and awareness and, you know, get a bit of momentum behind you before trying to pitch a concept to someone.
So when people come in here and they're pitching to us this great idea about another health product, for example, I mean, we get them in here, you know,
yeah,
people come in here with all sorts of raw foods, et cetera. One of the frustrations they all express is they've got nobody to distribute for them, and basically Woolworths is a distributor.
Yeah.
And what you're saying to them in terms of a negotiation with these organisations, you've got to be patient. And during that patience period, and you need patient capital, you've got to actually build up your brand and build up all the leverage points, work out where all the leverage points are for the potential distributor, who, therefore, that'll tell you who the distributor is going to be. So you need time.
Yeah.
Let's flip the script a bit, hey? Well, how do you approach a negotiation, Dad?
Exactly that. I'm very patient.
Is it much different, your environment, to...
No.
Or is every negotiation the same? Yeah. Arguing over a need and a want.
No, I'm like Nick. I will always look for who needs what I've got and what message they're trying to send to the marketplace, or alternatively, what are they trying to penetrate into the marketplace?
Mm.
So I'm very sort of purposeful and slow in my process. I don't ever expect anyone just to do what I'm after, straight up. And I'm usually waiting for them in some respects to come to me.
Do you subscribe to Nick's model about getting them to like you first? I can understand why Nick does it. It's harder to, you know, to say no to somebody that you like. But, I mean, you know, the alternate viewpoint on that is, do you want them to sort of not know you too much, not have too much of a close relationship to you, so that you can get a better angle at negotiating what you want?
Or? If I need to have that, if I suspect that's something I need in the negotiation, like a relationship, I won't do it myself. I get someone like Nick to do it. I won't get involved because I'm no good at that part.
Mm.
That's not my strength. You know, like,
is it better to know that person going into the negotiation?
It's easier
than not knowing them.
For me, it's always been easier if I have a contact in a bank, for example, where I'm trying to do a deal with. It's much better for me if I know the individual in there. But again, you can't, they're smart. You can't give them anything that I want.
Mm.
They've got to still want what you've got, and you've got to know what it is they want. So you've got to manufacture what it is they want and then make sure you deliver it to them. But it is easier if I know them. But it's very important, my view, as you do, there's a lot less friction in the two surfaces rubbing together if you have a relationship with them. Now, the relationship part of it is a real art. The art of negotiation should include the art of relationships. And that's where agents, managers, and people like Nick's business are really important, because not everybody's great at that relationship building. And the relationship building requires consistency, persistence, quality control, tone, language, you know, there's, you can't, on one hand, you don't want to be too big a suck, you know, you don't want to be, hey, how you going, you know, but you got to have something to say. But at the same time, you've got to be making sure that you communicate with those individuals as often as possible, you know, about relevant stuff.
How has it changed over the years for you? Like, from where these guys are now on the couch, the young startup in the corner there, to where you are now, has the form and format for you engaging in a negotiation evolved?
Oh, it's much easier for me now because people sort of tend to come to me. But when I was in their position, there's an assumption now that what I've got, everybody needs in my segments. Man, because, you know, I've been around long enough to do it.
So if you had to give these kids advice, you know, as to how to approach, and sorry, I called this guy's actually a lot older than me, the guy on the right, he looks younger, but he's, how old are you, Alistair? He's, Pat, how old's Pat?
I'm 37,
okay, sorry about that. But, you know, if you had to give them advice, you know, as to how to approach a negotiation at their age, at their stage of the life cycle in their business, how would that go?
They've got to get to know the person, or they've got to get to know the segment of who is the buyer of their product. And they've got to get to know relevant individuals or individuals with some authority within those particular organisations within the segment. And the only way you can do that is actually, I mean, you can keep hitting them up for a pitch, you can keep sending them data, you've got to build something as for free and relevant. The free part's really important. I think you keep providing free information, like just free data, and just keep hitting them up. I mean, look, people hit me up all the time, and I mostly ignore it. But then over a period of time, I start to direct it to someone else in my organisation. So, well, there might be something in this. You better have a look at it, because what I'm worried about, FOMO is a big issue. Like, I don't want to miss out.
No,
you know, particularly a new idea, I never want to miss out. But at the same time, I can't look at every bloody thing that comes my way. So if these guys are trying to put something to me, they've got to build up something that's credible and at the same time compelling. And to do that, there are lots of different ways. I mean, it could be sharp data, or it could be consistent data, or it could be just persistence. You know, you want to reward them their persistence.
Without being a pest.
Without them being a pest. And that's something they have to gauge, and there's a bit of luck involved in that. Yeah. You know, they've got to try and gauge me then. And or try not to misinterpret me. So compelling and persistence are two really important factors in them getting the light of day from someone like my organisation. And eventually what will happen is that what happens in my place is I flick it on to one of my CEOs and I just say, you better have a look at this just in case. Now, the next hurdle they have is that the person I send it to is so caught up in what their daily role is that they don't give it a light of day. They're just doing it because I've asked them to do it. And that can happen a lot. So what they should be doing then is just let me know that, oh, yeah, so-and-so from my organisation has called them. Give me some feedback as to how that meeting went.
Yep.
Because I send it.
Because you can use that when you negotiate, if you were to negotiate with them later on down the track as well.
I can use it. I can also, gives me a sense of, well, they're smart. They're copying me into everything. You know, they're more clever than I thought. But also what it does is it puts they're clever is because what they're effectively doing is put a stopper on just getting dealt up with by a person I referred it to who just looks at it as a matter of process. Because I'm sure that happens in your negotiation, Nick, all the time. You might get referred to somebody in the organisation and you just feel like you've just been dealt up and they just basically processed you and just so they can say to their boss, I spoke at Fordham about that concept. And then, you know, we have had examples of that.
Yeah. And the other thing as well on that it's, I suppose, the digital age of being able, when going back to Nick's question as well about have things changed, I think these days, you know, being able to fire off emails, connect with people on LinkedIn, connect with people on social media. You know, I did it just recently.
Keep the initial contact in the conversation or via the CC.
Always.
Yeah.
So you can't leave the negotiation. He's always there.
And you can find out more about the person. You know, you can find out. I just did it recently. It's not someone negotiating, but someone I'm working with, and found them on Instagram, their personal account on Instagram. So all of a sudden I looked at, you know, it's an open account. And all of a sudden I found out everything about this person. They got three kids, they live in the Shire, they used to work at X. You know, so it's amazing the digital age of actually being able to peel back and look in and find out a bit more about the person.
Because, I mean, this fear of missing out, it's a big factor.
Yeah.
Would you use today. That? Would you, like, if there's something that you know a great deal about, you know, if you say he's got a, you know, you like vintage cars or something like that, and or he's, you see him driving an antique Ferrari, or, you know, he's kicking a footy around or something like that, you'll factor that into lace it in there a bit?
Yeah, lace it in there a bit if needed, but, you know, you don't want to seem too desperate that, yeah. You know, I might have been searching through your social media account.
It's a bit scary.
Yeah. 45 weeks ago.
As a stalker, yeah.
So, I think it's important to just find out as much as possible the people you're dealing with. As I said, you know, having access to be able to communicate with people on email and to be able to phone. And, it's one of the things as well, always give advice to young people who want to get into journalism, I think one of the hardest industries to crack these days is journalism into television and radio, and just because there's so few opportunities. And if they're young enough and they can afford to, you know, work for free, do apprenticeships and things like that, is just be around, just hang around, just stay in front of them. Be relevant. When there's work opportunities, you know, put your hand up, work for free, and all of a sudden when they turn around, there's a job opening, you know, you're the first cab off the rank. And so many times I've seen people go the hard way of consistently just applying for jobs rather than saying, I'll get in the front door. And again, it comes back to familiarity and relationships of just being present, but again, not to the point of being a pest. You don't want to.
There's a fine line, and that requires judgment.
Yeah.
And you've got to exercise that judgment, like keep reassessing the position. Am I being a pest? Oh, hang on, can I actually go harder now? Can I go, as you're doing this all the time?
Yeah.
It's like hot and cold here.
Constantly reassessing and, you know, where the gauge is at of, you know, again, I always find as well, and these days when so many things are on email and phones and everything else, I always try and engage someone first on a call or email, but then try and meet them face to face. And I suppose that's another bit of advice from my end of for the listeners in terms of negotiation is trying to eyeball people. You know,
I was going to say, you're going to make your physical presence known, Nico.
Yeah, no, it's such an. Well, again, it's rapport, it's relationships, it's going out of your way to go and see someone. That's so important. You know, so many people can hide behind email and phone and everything else, and especially in big organisations, I've found it more and more these days that
we're doing something different, aren't you?
Yeah, and people are afraid to make decisions. You know, and that's the. Oh, in the example before about talking about supermarkets and getting into those things, that someone with an unknown product trying to get into Woolworths or Coles, it's like, well, go to the next level below, go to a, you know, Harris Farm or something like that, where privately owned, the person you're speaking to actually can make a decision, and not going through an 18, 24-month process of knocking on the same door and building a relationship with someone, and then all of a sudden the door
around.
Semi-opens and that person's now moved on to another role.
Well,
and
do both.
Do both, yeah.
Yeah. And how important, Nick, is or not just patience but time? So my view on negotiation is you should never drop your pants until you have to. And in terms of negotiation, you've got to be prepared to hold out your position, not ridiculously, but hold out your position. Like just
hang in there
because – and don't panic, it'll come. You know, like if you just – if you've got the right product,
yeah,
and you should only get the right outcome if you've got the right product in the first place. Mm. So if you've got the right product, eventually you'll get there. So if you've got them on the hook, don't be hassling them to finalise the negotiation. Just take your time.
And I suppose one of the luxuries in that point of a negotiation is having options.
Mm.
So always having a fallback option. Not
do you let them know about? I mean, do you try to sort of make it known to them that
if you don't do it with me, I'm going to go with someone else
in a very discreet way.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I'd never for a duck shot auction scenario of saying, well, if you don't do this, I'm going to go over here because
don't try and strong arm them or anything. Yeah.
Yeah, but subtly let them know that you know you have options.
Do you like leak it out or do you
what's that?
Do you leak it out or do you actually? And you subtly know, let someone Woolworths know if you don't do it with me, I'm going to go to Coles. I mean,
I think. It's subtly letting someone know, but yeah, I'm not into leaking things, and you know, especially when you're dealing with high-profile people, it's not something you want to in the marketplace of, you know, I think there's and the other thing as well, that's a risk in the negotiation of, you know, if something is leaked and you're negotiating someone, it's confidential information and it's then it's the DNA's traced back to you, well, then there's the all the trust that you've built up. Yeah, you've built up over the past 6-12 months goes out the door.
Again, it's where it becomes important that if you're dealing, we keep using Woolworths, but if you're dealing with a person, if you're dealing with Woolworths, try and deal with a person at Woolworths who you know, mm-hmm. who that sort of level of understanding allows you to subtly let them know yeah. that you would go to Coles. You don't yeah. even have to say that. They can sort of get the concept, well, this is the sort of bloke I'm dealing with. If I don't do a deal with him and I want the product enough, if I try to burn him on the pricing,
yeah.
he might go to Coles because
yeah.
I know him and because I've met him face to face. I get a sense of the guy.
Yes.
Whereas if you're dealing by email mm. or you're just dealing with at the wrong levels
yeah.
and have no relationship, they're never going to get the fact that you might go somewhere else.
Yeah.
In fact, they don't even care.
I was, I think I was one of the first people to jump on LinkedIn, I don't know, 10 years ago. And it'd be great to get someone from LinkedIn on the show at some stage because where I found LinkedIn quite valuable to me is, say I'm dealing with a certain person at a certain organisation and then they move off to another role, another organisation. Unless they send me their new details or say, hey, I'm out of here, this is where I'm at now.
Mm.
It's being able to, someone's at X company and they pop up at B company. But if I'm trying to connect with someone or you're trying to connect with someone that you want to work with, being able to, you know, often someone in your own network will know that person or be connected to that person. So that's where I found LinkedIn quite a powerful tool and a contact tool. But, you know, outside of that, it's I'm still trying to get my head around whether LinkedIn's really useful for me. I see they're improving, but it'd be good to get someone from LinkedIn on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually, I know I've got a contact there, but, you know, I wouldn't say he's the right guy to get in, but I might send him a LinkedIn message. And ask him to connect me with his boss.
Can I ask, how important is it to be tough? Like, you know, like...
When it's required, only when it's required.
Yeah.
I mean, when, like... Is there any point where you spit the dummy in?
Yeah. Like, put on the theatrics?
Yeah.
Not the theatrics, but I think being, you know, we're incredibly protective over our clients and people we work with, and I think once the communication really breaks down or starts to get a bit heated, well, you know, it's easy to fire up there and, you know, to make sure that people know that you're not a pushover and you're not going to be pushed around. So sure. I think save it for then, but don't – I've always hate hearing about people going to a negotiation and, you know, fist on the table and I want this and I want that. No, it's a
– Yeah, it doesn't
that doesn't work with people at all.
I saw what Todd Sampson was saying when he was in. He was saying don't – get anyone's back up against the wall because then the whole thing falls away.
Yeah, if you put the sword to somebody, you're just likely either they're either going to run or attack you.
Yeah. So. And again, people are afraid of making decisions these days and that's a frustrating thing for anyone in business.
Yeah.
You know, people don't want to be that guy that signed off on that.
Because there's so many options too, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, there's 100 options and you think, oh, shit, is that the right one or not the right one? If I go back 20 years, there weren't the options.
Yeah.
I was only thinking about how much harder a business is Yellow Brick Road is today compared to what Wizard was, because there was very few options in the Wizard days, and you know, there was very few investors around. Kerry Pack was one of them, but you know, if you're doing investment today, you'd be thinking, well, should I go to the market? Should I just go to some of these VCs? Should I go to find the Kerry Pack equivalent? Should I do a listing? I mean, like, there's too many options, and when there's more options, sometimes I'll be going to a restaurant I hate going to restaurants with massive menus. I'd rather go to a restaurant and say three entrees and three main meals.
Yeah.
It's just...
I was only saying that the other day. There's a great little business around... There's actually one in Potts Point now. It's called Coffee, Tea and Me. It started in Redfern where I live with my family. And it's in an old barbershop. So the barbershop would be 2 metres by 4 metres. It's tiny. And so no one else would lease his space. So I think he leases it for, you know, a couple of $100 a week. And he does great coffee and great bagels. And I would be surprised if he didn't sell, you know, 1,000 bagels a day, cash-only business. So now he's, when you work out the space that it is, but he only sells bagels.
He'll thank you later for tipping off the ATO. Well,
no, what he means is he doesn't need a factory, he's invoices.
Yeah. which we're going to talk about shortly. Cash is king, though.
Let's be honest. But also, because, you know, there's nothing better than getting the cash on the till there and then. I mean, there's nothing worse than having to wait to get bloody paid.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, I hate that. Yep. There's nothing worse than waiting 45 days or 50 days or a month or 2 months to get your money after you've already done the work and spent the dough.
Yeah.
I mean, so cash is really important.
Just on that as well, in terms of options and long menus, there's a mate of mine owned a pub in Surry Hills, the Excelsior Hotel, and he's a really good publican. And when he took it over, he, you know, got a new chef in and changed the menu, and the menu still was a pub menu. And he couldn't work out why he hadn't cracked it. And then Justin Hems comes along, buys it, and turns it into a Mexican restaurant. And the place, you can't move in the place, it's packed. So he took away people having to go through a menu and saying, do I want a shepherd's pie, do I want a pasta, or do I want a steak? It's like, no. You know what you're getting when you go there.
You know? You think Mexican, you go there.
Yeah. So it's taking the thinking away, you know.
Yeah, choices.
Yeah.
Because we're confronted with too many choices today. Actually, we're looking for no choice. One of my mates from Australia used to be a really good, he was a really great restaurateur, now he's in Bali, but the thing I used to love about going to his restaurant, as soon as I walk in there, I'd sit down there and he'd walk straight to me and the girl would come and say, you know, you would like a menu. And he said, no, don't worry about it, not getting the menu. He said, I'll sort it out for you. And I wouldn't even have a thing.
Perfect. Yeah.
And my meal would turn up. And it's like my mum cooking for me or something, you know. Like, it was a beautiful meal. Like, and no matter what he served me up, I thought it was great because I just didn't have to make the choice. The food was always good. But, I mean, like, he just took the choice away. When you go to a restaurant today, and if Neil Perry walks up to you and you sit down there, and you're at one of his restaurants like Rockpool, for example, and instead of getting the menu, which is normally what happens and you've got to look through it, imagine if he just walked up to you and said, g'day, Nick, look, mate, don't look at the menu. I'm going to sort out your lunch. You go, yeah, fuck yeah, how good is this? This is gold, you know, because you think you're getting something special.
Yeah.
And that is like, you know, that familiarity is that so good. That's the best there is.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we actually don't want to make too many choices in our life. So don't give them too many choices.
No.
So in terms of just closing off the negotiation piece here, Nick, maybe just three things you would suggest? Three important things you would do?
I would say relationships, perseverance, and making sure that your product is bulletproof in terms of you know exactly what your product is, that it's highly desirable and that they're not going to get it anywhere else. So they're probably my three sort of key piece of advice on entering into a negotiation.
I actually would say the same three things, or I might use different terms, but I'd say knowledge of where the demand is and what the demand is, where and what it is, who are the people likely to have choices, in other words, have options for yourself. Yep. One falls over, then you've got someone else to talk to. And finally, be patient. Don't expect it to happen quickly, because it never does. Righto, what's on next, Nico?
I think the boys over there have got everything they need. They're a financial services technology business, and this is a bit of an ambush. They're probably going to come over now and try and negotiate with you.
Okay, boys, come on over. Grab a mic.
Before I get this wrong again, Pat and Alistair.
That's right.
The boys came and saw me end of last year. We had a good chat over a coffee. They've got and correct me if I'm wrong, an invoice discounting business. It's set up to and designed to improve cash flow for small businesses. Guys that, you know, they're not bad and doubtful debts. They're not, you know, crappy, junky invoices. It's simply a timing thing. You know, you got a 90-day invoice from NAB or one of those, you know, reputable organizations. You need your money now. You go to see these guys. They've got a marketplace set up. They do all the relevant checks and balances and hopefully get your money sooner.
Okay, who's who? Which one's which?
So I'm Pat. This is Alistair.
Okay, who's going to do the pitch to me?
Well, we can kick it off by firstly just re-emphasising what Nick said. We're actually taking a step back to just being invoice finance. We're looking at more holistically, looking at cash flow. So we look at that cash flow cycle for an SME and kind of understand the challenges within that cycle. And our whole philosophy is building tools to kind of smooth out those hurdles. So your typical hurdles when a cash flow cycle is, making sure you negotiate the right terms and making sure that you're actually, that process of invoicing is rock solid. because as soon as it's not, that's an excuse for not to be paid. Then there's also forecasting, so actually having a clear understanding of what cash flow you have, what cash you have coming in, what cash you have going out. And then, of course, there's the whole point of optimizing that cash flow. So we've looked at that whole cycle, and then we're building tools around those. And those tools, firstly, are going to help us forecast cash flow better for an SME. So this is a tool for an SME to understand 6 months in advance, okay, when are those challenges coming? And how do I make sure I can get through those? Because it's not about, you know, survival, it's about growth. So you want to have the cash available to do that. Mm-hmm. On the other side, of course, we want to optimize. So that's where we're using our invoice finance or invoice discounting model to help them accelerate.
Where do you come from? What's your backgrounds?
So my background's finance. I started off in the UK working for a bond fund. Then I came back here about 2002, worked for a hedge fund for a few years. Then I went to Hong Kong for a little over 8 years, and I was working in equities as an analyst and portfolio manager. And then for the last 3 years, I've just been working on startup projects and sort of, yeah, I guess trying to work out where the opportunities are in finance, in fintech. Obviously, the industry's going through a lot of changes, and that's presenting a lot of opportunities.
So. And your background?
My background's financially orientated as well. I started at NAB in corporate agribusiness. Then I went over to the UK for 5 years, and I worked in a very similar business. It was called Market Invoice. So that was the first UK P2P invoice finance lender over there. I worked with them from pretty much startup till last year, and was, you know, gaining a lot of experience there. Saw fintech really, you know, blossom over in the UK. It's going gangbusters over there now. And I was just buying my time waiting for Australia to really catch on. And it's quite a buzz now. Like it was.
Before you go any further, you guys just recently rebranded. What's the name of the business now?
Yeah. We're now called Skipper. So Skipper, take control of your cash flow. So SKIPPR. We'd love to have the PER, but that's a very popular domain.
That's more startup style anyway. We're just the R in the end.
Exactly. Yeah. Just drop the vowels. Skipper cash flow. You know, it's a more embodying, holistic brand now, mm-hmm. because we've got those tools underneath it that represent, you know, each part of the cash flow cycle.
I'm just curious on the factoring, on the invoice discounting side. So let's say I've got an invoice from our favourite bank. I've got an invoice out to our favourite bank, NAB. So I've done some work for NAB, for argument's sake.
Mm-hmm.
NAB don't pay until 45 days after the beginning of the next month, for example. I don't know if they do or if they don't, but I'm just making this up.
Yep.
So, like, I do the work on the 1st of February. They don't pay me till sometime on that formula, sometime in March, okay? 15th of March, for argument's sake. But my cash flow, I'm running my business and I need that $10,000 because I've got to pay staff, I've got to pay rent, blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
I come along to you guys. Is this how it works?
Yep.
Or online?
Yeah.
Do you go to online?
It's 100% online.
So I make some sort of application to you,
mm-hmm.
tell you the circumstances. Obviously fill out all the fields.
Mm-hmm.
You say to me, okay, Mark, that 10 grand will give you how much?
Well, I mean, if it's NAB, it's, you know, presumably a high quality debtor. If you've got a history of, you know, doing business with NAB, and, you know, it's not a case of them, you know, they pay you on time. It's just that you have to wait for that payment.
Yeah.
And we can verify that. Then you'd be looking at sort of potentially a 1% discount on a 30-day basis.
So on the $10,000, how much do I get?
Well, 99 cents on the.
Yeah, but essentially up front, you get your 85% of it up front, straight up,
okay, right.
Yep. And then when it gets paid, we'll give you the remaining residual, yep. less the cost of capital.
Okay, so cost, okay, that's 1%. So, and you obviously lower the cost of capital. That's where you make your money, I guess, is it?
Yeah.
And is there a fee in there as well?
We take a discount fee, so we don't actually fund the invoices ourselves.
No, I was going to ask you that. Where's the money coming from?
Mm. Yeah, so it's a marketplace. So the business itself doesn't fund the invoices. We have a, you know, there'll be structures set up to.
So you, like, you guys selling into a marketplace? You got like a investor marketplace that follows you?
Yeah, we do. So ideally, when the marketplace is up and running, we will have. We'll have investors that come on board, and they set mandates for what debtors they would like exposure to. And on that basis, we can then fund, the invoices that come through, depending if they're matching up with those debtors.
Sort of like peer-to-peer for SMEs.
Yes.
That's right, yeah.
Peer-to-peer funding for SMEs. Invoicing, so yeah. It's a bit complicated to say, but it's like what Matt Symonds does for Society One.
Yes.
Yes.
So you guys build the algorithm or someone else does it?
Yes, yeah, so we do that all internally.
Right, so what you guys got is you got a platform, electronic platform, mm-hmm. digital platform, which assesses, in our case, the example here, the NAB debt, me as a provider of the service to NAB, I guess.
Yep.
And then puts it up on your platform, and some investor out there could be Nick Fordham, who's looking to get a return on 10 grand that he's got in his pocket at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and he wants to get a quick return. It's better than what he's going to get in the bank. If he puts it in the bank, he's going to get 2%, maybe less. He's thinking, well, I wouldn't mind getting a better return for that three-month period.
Mm-hmm.
Nick bids on that. Is that what we're talking about? Nick Fordham will say, yeah, I'll take that NAB debt. I'll give Boris $8,500.
Mm.
He advances me the money through you guys. You guys collect the $10,000 from NAB.
Yeah, that's correct.
And you give me the balance, and Nick gets in return, and you take a clip.
Correct.
That's right.
That's it?
Yep.
That's the process. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. So it's a peer-to-peer, sort of nearly like a lending business, but it's a peer-to-peer financing business.
Correct.
Definitely, yes.
So
yes.
I think it's an important but subtle distinction, is that we're not actually, or the investors aren't lending money, they're purchasing an asset.
Mm. So. And they take all the risk, do they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious about how you guys evaluate all this debt, because Matt Symonds did a roadshow at Bell Potter, and he's incredibly sophisticated what he does with Society One. I mean, how good are you guys at evaluating the quality of that debt? You know, whether or not there's an existing relationship. Cost of capital, right? You're gonna have to be constantly assessing the value of that asset class, the opportunity cost, where else I can invest. What that cost of capital is for me in that particular asset class. How do you guys get into all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think when you're looking at a model like Society One, like they're providing a lot of personal lending. It's a personal lending product, so it's far high risk.
Yeah,
it's unsecured lending.
Yeah,
we're providing invoice finance against an asset, and we understand the nature of that asset pretty clearly. So, of course, we do the typical credit. Credit analysis. So you can look at transactional track record with that business. So you're looking by zero. We're pulling in their accounts. We're looking at their financials, looking at their bank statements. Then we're really drawing focus onto their debtor. And so you look at that debtor. If they're, we're looking at B2B here, and really, the main problems within this whole in the whole market is B to big B, so business to big business. That's where the cash flow issues are.
What's the intermediary there that allows you to check that invoice is in fact real? It exists.
That's part of one of the tools that we're building. So there are systems out there. They're called EDI systems. Big customers like Woolworths, they do use online electronic data transfer systems, essentially. So that invoice is on a portal. You can log into that and you can see that the invoice, the goods have been delivered, the invoice has been received, so it's going to get paid. That provides you a lot of certainty that the payment's going to be made. Yeah. So you've ticked one box there. Then you understand, okay, it's Woolworths. So they're not going to fall over anytime soon, even though they've been looking pretty shaky recently. But
they're rated, so.
Exactly. So it's a pretty much a done deal there. Like, they're going to get paid.
Just make sure it's not a Masters invoice.
Exactly. as of last week.
Or Dick Smith.
And Dick Smith as well.
Won't be touching any Dick Smith invoices for the foreseeable future, that's for sure. And if you've just legitimized that invoice, you mitigated a lot more risk. So when you're comparing like our risk appetite compared to like just a short-term loan or a personal loan, we've taken a few more steps to mitigate more risk. So that's where these tools are going to help us.
And do you price it? Do you put a suggested range out there to the marketplace, or the market comes back to you and says, this is what we want to pay?
Yeah, so there's two ways an invoice can be sold, essentially. There's one in the auction-based model, which you referred to earlier. And then there's also where the buyer creates mandates, and they dictate the parameters of how they would like their portfolio allocated, and then we use internal pricing for that.
What's the hard part? There's three hard parts to this, but what's the hardest part? Finding the invoice customers, like, the person who's issued the invoice. There's the algorithm, make sure that works, keeping that Nice. And then find the investors, which is the hardest part.
Yeah, so I think lead generation is probably the hard part. It's a new product. I guess trying to explain how this works to people, getting their trust, because taking on funding is a huge decision for a business. And traditionally they've gone to the banks. If they can't go to the banks, then they go to sort of a reputable finance name. This is a new model, and it's like. For a lot of people, it's sort of getting them comfortable with that new model.
So because
they're looking for punters essentially to invest in it. This is was my and there's always a negative to any business, so please don't be offended. But there'd be no institutions out there that have a mandate for this stuff. So you're relying on like high net worth guys and family offices and people to buy
SMEs.
That. On the investment side, the SMEs love it, right? Because like you were saying, if you're a big corporate, you can go to a bank and get some short-term mezz or whatever to get you over the line, right? Mm. But if you're a SME, who's got
it's very challenging.
Yeah, exactly, yep. Right. That you guys might be their only option for finance, right?
Yeah, no, we're filling a massive void in the SME market.
Who is your competitors? Because there are old-school factoring organisations, banks for start to do it. Who are you?
Well, there's the factoring market. It's a $64 billion market right now. That's factoring and invoice discounting. So that's
mostly the banks.
That's mostly the banks. And then there's those little factor houses out there. And then there's the likes of Scottish Pacific. That's that model. That's invoice discounting. But then there's also the short-term lenders out there. And, of course, there's the bank.
Why are you better than the traditional factoring organisation? What's better about what you're doing?
It's coming
for a consumer, for an SME, I should say.
It's really we've looked at that model and we've gone, okay, well, what are the main shortfalls of that model? And we've taken them out. And really, it comes down to how you charge the customer and how they use the product. And so ours is far more flexible. So just give an example: a factoring line. Traditionally, you pay to sign up. It's a structured line. It's charging against your monthly receivables ledger. It's pretty much locked in for the year or even 2 years. So there's a lot of hidden fees and costs in there, and they can really blow out. So you can't just look at the percentage interest. We've stripped that back and saying, well, you just select what you need to finance. So you look at your ledger and go
per transaction.
Yep, per transaction, pay as you use, and fund as you need. You look at the ledger each time you're probably using we've got a cash flow forecasting tool where it's a free product we've built for businesses so they can understand, when they need finance. They go, okay, well, right now I need to unlock another 50K to make sure I can cover month-end costs. They pick invoices based on the risk profile of those invoices, which, we're going to give them foresight of and go, this is the pricing you're going to get. And then they just fund against those invoices. So they're only getting charged against the invoices they actually want funding from. And you literally turn that on and turn that off whenever you need it.
Okay, so you've built in some subtle but probably important differences. Where are you guys up to now? How are you funding all this yourselves? Your ops, your operational funding, and how are you doing it?
We've done a small capital raise.
The man at Macquarie that I'm yet to meet, where's he at today? He's at work. they got a partner who works at Macquarie Bank. He also emails me every now and then.
Yeah, so we've done a small cap raise through family and friends.
Typical startup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You go to your family and friends.
Yeah, so we were self-funded for the first 6 months. Then we did a small cap raise. So we're still majority owners of the business. And I think now the big focus is just, the most important source of funding is revenue. And that's our big focus going forward.
So in terms of your stage of growth, where you are, have you built everything? Do you guys sort of sit in an incubator somewhere? How are you doing this?
Yeah, we're actually housed at the Tyro Payments FinTech Hub.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been there for nearly 8 months now, I think. And, that's been, invaluable. The connections, the introductions, and even just the mentorship there is fantastic.
Is that down on near Spring Street in the city there? No.
It's near Barrack Street on Clarence.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
that's where Tyro is. Yeah, there's a few hubs around now. Yeah. But I suppose there's two dedicated fintech hubs. That's Stone & Chalk and Tyro. Okay. We're there. We're using, really leveraging those resources well. And so it's been fantastic.
So what do they offer you?
Well, it's essentially, at the moment, it's quite a co-working space with useful connections.
So just explain that in. People listening, they don't really know what you're talking about. So right. You mean, what do you got there? A desk? Have you got a free internet? I mean, what do you got?
That's right.
Yeah, so first of all, we've got heavily subsidised desks. So we're staying in a pretty nice office and we're not paying much for it.
What do you pay? $100 a month or what do you?
No, it's $600 a month per desk right. Or thereabouts.
And you share a desk or you got a desk each? Or?
No, we have desks for each member of the team.
How many in your team?
Four
of you, right. Yeah. So $2,400 a month you pay for rent effectively.
For grade A office space.
And desk means chair, desk, drawers.
Printing.
Wi-Fi.
Yeah,
meeting kitchen. Rooms. Yeah. Air conditioning.
That helps.
Really matters at this time of year. It's better than the
something
home
you
office.
Don't get on the Mark Boris show. Yeah.
Well, we love you to build up a sweat.
Really bootstrapping it. Yeah.
But I think the important point is that Tyro's Australia's newest bank.
Tell me a little bit. I don't know them. Who are they?
Yeah, no,
they are. So they started in the early 2000s, and their focus was payments. So the point of sale terminals that you see, they're one of the sort of key players in that space. They've just grown really rapidly because they're focused on technology. I think it's fair to say that hasn't been a strong point for a lot of the banks over the last 15, 20 years, and that's a real differentiating point for Tyro.
And do they get a part of some equity in you guys or first at you or something?
It's part of their philosophy because they started up as a fintech company 15 years ago when no one the word fintech didn't exist. And they went through all the trials and tribulations that that we're all going through now. So I guess it's something that they philosophically believe in, is supporting fintech businesses, because there's the market's been dominated by the big banks for too long. They really want to try and encourage
innovation.
How long
do they stay there? I mean, you're going to move in forever, but how does it work?
It's all subject to how well we go, I suppose.
They're assessing your progress, are they?
there's certain elements of structure around it. I think a lot of that's actually happening this year because they're quite a new hub. I think there's a little bit more formal structure coming into play in the next couple of months. So we're going to be intrigued to see what that looks like.
When's your next round of raising money?
I guess it's not really on a set timetable. It will depend on what we see. We find an investor that comes along and says, I can do this and this for you. Our interests are aligned, our philosophies are aligned, then we would certainly look at that.
You want a strategic partner.
Correct. Yeah. So it's not, I mean, we're not desperate for cash right now, and as we're about to launch, we're going to go through that. I guess we're going to start having revenues in the next few months.
So when are you going to launch?
Well, we can actually, the funding platform's live now, and the cash flow tool will be live in the next few weeks, but it's very much a testing phase. So we're not going hard just yet.
You got live clients on there though?
we will in the next few weeks.
Right, so Skipper will go live. Is it 1P or 2Ps?
2Ps.
2Ps. So Skipper will go live, so someone's listening to this and they're an SME, they can go on a Skipper as of now?
Yes. Yeah, the website's live, skipper.com.au is live.
Do they transact or they just test?
Well, they can. I mean, it's very much at this point in time, it's just clients that understand that this is where we are in the process. I guess every business has to start somewhere, and it's very much a testing phase. So we can fund, but
is there
we
any
have
risk
limited
them going, putting themselves up there, like at this this testing stage of your technology.
Not in the sense that it's more about getting the product fit right as opposed to using them to see if we can actually lose their money. Yeah. So it's very much a case of yes, we can fund you, but we just want to make sure the product makes sense for as many SMEs as possible.
And have you built this? And we're gonna have to close up now. But you built this up on a model that exists somewhere else in the world, like in the UK. You mentioned the UK.
Yeah, I worked at a company that offers the same finance model
online.
Yep. Yeah, it's called Market Invoice, and they've done an online P2P invoice.
And has it done well?
It's a the market leading product over there, and they've done £650 million through the platform in invoice volume. So still a very small part of the market, but they've
What's
had
that
a
revenue for the business.
It's for them. It's about 2.5 to 3 million a year in revenue. So it's still small fry, but it's a scale business. Yeah.
So you sort of believe in the asset class, really.
The asset class,
as
definitely.
As opposed to small market, but you reckon it's going to grow.
I think there's a lot of opportunity out there. Like, you look at invoice finance market, $64 billion, but then that's a market that's servicing, you know, a very finite part of the SME space, because you have to meet certain criteria in order to be able to use invoice finance in the right way. Our product's a little bit more malleable and flexible to other businesses, so we're going to actually, you know, our focus is actually to go into verticals, different markets, parts of the SME market that don't usually use debt finance in this way. It's like to fund cash flow.
How do you educate? I mean, I'm going to finish off on this because I'm keen to get the nod, but how do you educate? I mean, is it important for you to go out and educate SMEs about cash flow? I mean, I don't even think SMEs understand what the hell cash flow means. I mean, they just go on there, so should I got a product, got to pay rent, revenues will come. This education process needs to come first.
So I think that's the key point about our business. We're not necessarily a funding platform. We're more of a cash flow management platform with a funding component to it.
Yeah.
And so all the tools that we're building are helping businesses understand their cash flow better.
And they're free.
Correct. Oh, well, the funding tool's not free.
No.
Yeah, but
that's the revenue-facing side. The other stuff, the planning and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, that's correct.
Right. Yeah, the cash flow tool's free, and it's a way for a business to help understand it, and it helps us understand their business as well.
And it also helps you introduce yourself to somebody and allows you then, I mean, that's the old give something away free.
It definitely helps with acquisition. Yeah.
That's about your acquisition strategy, which is clever.
And that acquisition goes down to, you know, towards advisors and accountants as well. You know, they're a key point of education for an SME. Like, everyone still relies on their accountant to understand how they're going. Mm. So, you know, we're designing that tool in order to be useful for an accountant to feedback information down the line as well.
And the key will be for you to get the message out to everybody to use Skipper. Yeah. And I mean, to get into Skipper for the reasons you've just explained, particularly your best allies are going to be the accountants and advisors. Yeah,
that's what MIB and Xero did, you know. Like, they all use their stuff. And that would have been MIB and Xero just shoving it down their throat every
day. Xero's been a very big evangelist of financial management for SME these days. And, like, we're using Xero now. We're using their API. We're going to be connecting across all the other accounting platforms as well. The more APIs we can bolt into, so more accounting software platforms we can bolt into, the better data we have and the more market access we have as well.
Sure.
Okay, well, good luck to Skipper. I mean, it's a complex thing to explain to on a show like this. But as SMEs grow and grow and grow, particularly in this country, it's going to become, I think, cash flow is the most important part for an SME to be successful or otherwise.
That's right.
I don't mean in the idea stage, but I mean in the sustainability part of their business. In other words, survival. For an SME to survive, don't give a shit how good the idea is. They've got to be able to manage the cash flow.
Agreed.
And and understand the cash flow, or just understand the concept. So good luck, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Thanks for having us on your show as well.
You're most welcome.
Yeah. Appreciate it, Mark. Thank
you, guys.
Looking forward, this is the week ahead.
So next week, I thought we might have a look at some internal TMBS plans for this year. What do you reckon? Have a bit of a chat.
What do you mean you want us to talk about our plans?
Yeah.
Why not talk about
how we're in
Gatlin. We're going to have a planning meeting.
Well, we get a lot of these guys, you know, hit us up every week, and I just want to, you know, keep a touch on our audience and stay engaged and make sure that we're, growing with you guys. You know, I mean, having all you guys around us make us what we are. So,
I guess what we should be doing is asking listeners to tell us, email us in or tweet something or whatever, just say, well, what is it they want us to talk about this year? What do they want us to cover off and look at and research? And how important is it to bring in startups like these guys and listen to their story?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, I'm looking forward to that. That'll be cool. Okay, guys, that's a wrap. We'll go see you guys this time next week.
This has been the Mark Boris Podcast. You can follow Mark on Twitter @MarkBoris and find out more at markboris.com.au.